What is that cycle? Well, it's also called just the water cycle. So hydrologic is just kind of a fancy term, or hydro for short, but it's the water cycle. It is the natural occurrence of water and how it is transported within this earth and ultimately makes its way full round and touches really a lot of things. And the temporal part of it is fairly variable. But the key is what we know today, and we take a lot for granted, is that the ocean is the ultimate deposit or repository for most of the water here on Earth. It is evaporated and also what's called evapotranspiration, in which the plants will pull water out of the ground and put it into the atmosphere. Ultimately, the sun is the big driver. Clouds are the big transporter or the conveyor belt of moving water over the land and the continents. And then we get precipitation in various forms, mainly rain, some snow, and then obviously a little bit of hail. But then obviously the groundwater or the water will move into groundwater. It'll actually get absorbed into the ground. It'll move in the ground. There's some parts of that we'll talk about because that was something historians were really hung up on. And it also obviously will flow along stream flow or river flow and make its way back to the ocean. Well, that's the simplicity of it. There is a little bit more to it and a lot more science to it, or else I really wouldn't have a very good job and career path. It wouldn't distinguish me very much, but the key is this idea is something we're introduced to typically around the junior high years, and then we get into it a little bit more in high school, and by the time we get out of high school, we take a lot of this for granted. Well, that wasn't the case for the ancients. The ancients had to start out with developing something and trying to hypothesize and theorize how these things were actually working. They were taking natural observations, and unfortunately, sometimes observations are skewed based on our perspective and also based on various things that we're introduced to. So I want to start in the Greek philosophical time period, and that's around 600 to 350 BC. Just a quick synopsis of who these philosophers were. You'll be reminded of some of them. Thales, Herodotus, Hippocrates, Xenophanes, and Anaxagoras, but the main two you probably know, Plato and Aristotle. And while I was over in Greece this year, it's Plato. I kept saying it wrong. They kept getting upset. I apologize for that, but my English isn't so good over there. But Plato and Aristotle. And these individuals really helped to formulate the ideas early on about what this hydrologic cycle was all about. And they shared different things about it. And they shared them within their schools, philosophical schools, and they certainly built upon the ideas of which they expressed. But one of the big problems was being in the Greek setting, Greece, as well as Italy, the Roman period we'll talk about here in a moment, those countries are dominated geologically by limestone or even marble. That's why you have the wonderful edifices over there, statues and buildings. But the big thing about that is, and if you live in Missouri and other places, like even Florida, you know that there's something called karst, meaning cavernous bodies or caves, and then you get underground water flow at a much higher rate than you would in other places on the continents. And because of these things, they were mystified by them. They were mystified by the springs because literally you had rivers of water just seemed to kind of emanate out of the earth. And that had a huge impact on what they thought. They really thought that wind was the big driving force of this particular system. And we know today, though, that the sun, radiative energy, and also gravity play a big part on how the cycle works. The radiative part's what gets it into the atmosphere. Then gravity does the rest to get it back down on the land and back into the oceans. And so not understanding those things and also including a little bit of Greek, well, some early stories that came from various people, they started to build their mythology around their philosophical views and vice versa. And one of the things that came out of that is Plato proposed the idea of what's called Tartarus. And Tartarus was this huge, vast, underground, cavernous system that is depicted here in Kircher's work in the 1600s. And what he hypothesized is that you had two different realms, and we won't go into all of these because there's a lot of doctrinal things that will start to come out of it, including Hades. But anyway, there was a fiery center, but with this elaborate cavernous system, a void system within the earth, and it was the ultimate repository of all of the water that we see flowing on the surfaces today. And the springs that were flowing out, rivers of water, were ultimately being swelled through the earth in some way, and the mechanisms they certainly debated, but ultimately this water would move about and come out, and you see these big caverns underneath every single mountain, because every single mountain to them was hollow. It was hollow. And so even Aristotle proposed that this water rises up, and just like water would condense in the atmosphere or in a closed room with a high humidity against a glass pane or something of that effect, that ultimately water must be condensing inside the mountains, and the cool of the mountain created this water flow, and that came out of springs. Now, that's just the best they could do. And it's really, you know, it's imaginative, but that was the early views that ultimately stemmed the hydrologic cycle from their perspective. Well, we move into the Roman philosophical time in the first century BC and first century AD. And we have some individuals that come along, not as many, but Lucretius, Vitruvius, and Seneca are some of the bigger proponents of trying to put out not only the views, but also trying to build upon the views. And so one of the things they came up with, for instance, was the idea of creation of dew. That was a big issue. They thought that in the morning when you woke up and there was dew on the plants or on certain materials, that was newly created water. Well, what's important about that? Well, what they're saying is that this is an open system, that you have new inputs into the system all the time. Well, I'm going to show you here in a minute. Well, we've already noted, but it's a cyclic process, but it's a closed system. Nothing leaves or exits or enters the world except for very, very minute cases. But overall, it's a closed system. Nothing new is created or added to the system. Nothing is permanently lost. It just may be in storage for a long period of time. But ultimately, this material, they said, was created. It would go back down the earth. This would help to create the stock of water that was needed to travel down the rivers year to year. And ultimately, they had the idea that wind was a transporter. They started to get that at least right to some degree. The problem was how the clouds work, and they certainly debated on that. And that they thought them more like sponges and things like that. Of course, they thought even the mountains were kind of spongy at some point in time. But they didn't understand the evaporative or transportive processes that are going on that gets the liquid into the atmosphere. And then they ultimately just came out and bluntly stated in numerous cases, all the way down through Aristotle, that there is no way that rain and snow is sufficient for all the water flow in the river and stream systems on the earth. Just no way. In fact, Aristotle came out and said, we won't even call a river if it's from rainfall. It's just simply a swollen vessel. Instead, a river is that which only emanates from a cavern in the earth, and that the biggest rivers must come from the biggest mountains with the largest cavernous bodies inside them. That was Aristotle. So these individuals had a huge impact on the worldview that people took regarding this, and ultimately they just really were building upon some of that Greco-Subterranean view views passed along earlier. Here's just an example of another particular piece. You can see here, here's an Aristotelian view of an empty mountain. There's a subterraneous ocean, and then as you can see, here's fountains and springs coming forth and ultimately springing and flowing down the valleys towards the ocean. So this is kind of a cross-sectional view under a mountain. And you see the trees around it for scale. Here's another one. This comes from some other works that was later translated through Kircher, who did a really good job of capturing some of these ideas. Here they're trying to figure out mechanisms, right? You got water flowing into the system. Supposedly this is ice and a cooling effect. Here you have, obviously, hot springs in the area, so there must be some fiery source underneath. But then it's got to move up under the void of a mountain to ultimately spring out and actually flow on the earth. And so these are interesting, but this one I like. This is actually from Kircher's work that came out around the just before the Renaissance. And Kircher proposed whirlpools in the ocean. The black conduits are the conduits which ultimately bring the water from the ocean back up into the mountains. He decided it just flowed directly and that it springed up underneath the mountains instead of condensating. And then it flowed outside of the mountains, making their way back to the ocean. Of course, some of these great pictures not only show sailboats, but they'll show little sea serpents and things like that, and that kind of goes along with their view of that time. But the idea of giant whirlpools in the ocean have certainly not been substantiated. Well, the Renaissance era comes in the 1500s to 1700s. We've got Leonardo da Vinci. I know we think of him as a painter, but he actually was a very good scientist. We have Palissy, Perrault, Kircher, and even Edmund Halley, who are helping us to really get to the understanding that we now have today. It was referred to as the Great Scientific Awakening, and it certainly was a great time in science because experimentation and calculations started to be used to determine what's the rainfall, for instance, in the French area around the Seine River, and what's its flow, and do they actually add up? Actually, what was found out is that three times the rainfall falls in that part of France than what the Seine actually brings back to the ocean, meaning that two-thirds of it's getting absorbed into storage in groundwater, lakes, or lost back to evaporation, transpiration. And so this is the time in which we start to appreciate what's going on. The modern theory finally takes shape. So there's our picture once again to remind us all of these things taking place. And it took a very long time for man to figure this out on his own. Long time. And he had a lot of missteps along this path of trying to understand this. And again, we could talk more about this, and there's some fantastic quotes I could share, but we'll try to get that out in a literary work in the future. So how about the water cycle in the Bible? This is where we want to spend our time. So notice I've also qualified this. Post-flood, we could get into a huge debate what's going on before the flood. We only want to focus on the post-flood hydrologic cycle after that particular miracle. So Ecclesiastes 1 and 7. This is one that is famously known and quoted by a number of people, but you'll be interested to find out how it's quoted and used by certain individuals. Ecclesiastes 1 and 7 just simply says, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. So it sounds like, right off the bat, this is the same cycle of which we've been talking about. But remember, we've got our modern glasses on right now, and our focus is thinking about it from that particular position. The question becomes could it be the other direction? Well, rivers flow along a gradient by gravity toward the lowest elevation, the ocean. It's a gravity-driven system. Seas don't continually fill, and the reason is because, as I noted, it's a closed system, and that's proof of it. In fact, if you were to have all the rivers run into the ocean and it was to be a new system, you would even, in fact, hardly even see the ocean rise because of how insignificant and inconsequential that volume is in comparison to the ocean itself. And so these individuals back in that time would have had no way to figure that out and to be able to fathom that idea. You know, he says there, from which they come, they return, noting it is a cyclic process. And so that part is extremely accurate. So this information, just that those light notes there, already is a huge improvement upon anything that the ancient philosophers would have proposed all the way up to the first few hundred years A.D. Because they didn't think it to be an open system. They didn't understand it to be fully cyclic. They didn't grasp those particular elements or include the gravity part as much as it should have. So the question is, where do the rivers come from? The question is the place, as noted here, the sea? Now that would certainly seem to fit the subject because the sea is mentioned. Well, they proposed, many of the ancients did, is that it was another reservoir, the subterranean reservoir such as Tartarus, and that the ocean was simply along that conveyor process. It was a part of the process, but it wasn't a significant part of the process, let alone the reservoir. So we're going to come back to this passage at the very end, and in the meantime, we want to build on some other passages. Now, one thing I will note before we go into this verse is that, as has been stated, and accurately so, the Bible is not a scientific textbook. But if it is of inspiration, we have every right to test it for its scientific technicality to determine whether or not it is truly the Word of God. And that's why we're doing what we're doing here this morning. We're looking to see, is the Word of God truly inspired, or does it have mistakes? And that's why we'll have to spend some time here in a minute going into some word studies, such as we'll start here at looking at the passage in Amos. Amos 5 and 8 says, he calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth. The Lord is his name. This is almost repeated verbatim with a little bit added to it in Amos 9 and 6, where Amos says, He who builds his layers in the sky and has founded his strata in the earth, who calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth, the Lord is his name. Now we're going to bog down a little bit, but stay with me. We need to examine these words. And the reason we need to examine the words is because in the English, it may look straightforward. In the Hebrew, which got me completely out of my element, humbled me quite a bit on this study, that's where the intricacies start to come in. And the key is you can see it when you compare different translations. And you might think to yourself, since it was mentioned earlier when Brother Ron was talking about the candlesticks or even the lampstands, some versions might go so far as to say lanterns or even real liberally like flashlights. Now, all of those things are illuminators. But when I talk about those things, they are distinctly different, especially from their composition, from how they're used, what their power source is, and how well they illuminate. So the key is, if we're going to examine the scientific context of these particular statements, we need to dive in a little bit deeper to understand whether or not they're going to hold value or if there is a potential mistake found. So I want to look at Amos 9 and 6, since it has the material in it that's a little bit more. If some things are very straightforward, I'm not going to mess with those words. But if there are some intricacies that we need to appreciate to draw out of the text, then we'll spend time on those. The first word is the word up here, layers. The word layers in the King James Version, for instance, is the word stories, only found as stories in that particular verse. Everywhere else you look for this word in the Scriptures, you'll find that this word actually can mean stairs, steps, or degrees of increment. So the word layer is actually pretty decent, but it's the idea of stepped layers. Let me go forward for just a moment. Do we have layers in the atmosphere? Absolutely. We have layers in the atmosphere, and from the perspective of the ground, sometimes you can't appreciate them. Sometimes you can see them moving contrast to one another. But only from an aerial standpoint do you really get to appreciate just how complex that system is and how it works. He goes on, he's going to talk about here in just a moment, the strata below, which is simply a word that is defined typically as a band of troops, something to deal with sometimes formations or groupings of them. Now, from the perspective already as a geologist, my question is how did the ecclesiastical or the Amos actually even understand the composition of the earth and how layered it is? I doubt he drilled an oil well. I doubt he took electric logs. I doubt he went out and did some kind of outcrop study and made a regional stratigraphic composition of it. So how did he know that? And how did he understand the layers of the sky? Well, at least the layers of the sky he could observe, but still it's a little bit convoluted from a ground perspective. So that part is very interesting. But let's look at what else he has to say. Well, he uses the term sky. The word sky there is an interesting word. It is the space above the earth. It is also translated the air, where the birds fly, in Genesis 1, 26 through 30. And it is also where wind exists, Zechariah chapter 2 and verse 6. And we'll come back and we'll talk about that term because it's going to come up a few times through our study. The word waters is a generic term. It is used for just about any water body on the earth, such as the seas, the ocean, the rivers. It can also be used for certain vessels, such as wells, pitchers, glasses. And it can also be used in a number of ways, referring to certain adjectives or verbs such as drinking and washing, especially washing of feet. And so it is just a generic term. It'll come up many times, but rest assured it doesn't change. Of the sea, now that particular phrase is an interesting phrase. The waters of the sea. So it qualifies which waters these are. And now this is a generic term used of the waters, versus that of a vast subterranean source. That's important. That's important to know. We're not talking about a subterranean source. We're talking about waters of the ocean. Waters of the ocean, or a large physical surface water body. And then it says that he pours these out. Now, the word to pour out in the Hebrew has to do with the shedding or the pouring out, most often in reference to blood. But it is also used of water, can be used such as with relation to God's fury, God's fury poured out. And also, one that might be of intrigue to you, the pouring out of His Spirit, such as in the prophecy of Joel 2, 28 and 29, found later again in Acts 2, verses 17 and 18. And so the idea of that which is in this system is ultimately drawn in and then released. And so it shows that there is some kind of process at play. But let's go and look at Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 13, which is repeated verbatim in chapter 51, verse 16, and then is ultimately quoting Psalm 135, verse 7, starting right here. So Jeremiah adds a little bit of flavor to this when he says, "When he utters his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens, and he causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He makes lightning for the rain. He brings the wind out of his treasuries." Now, there's a number of things to draw from this particular passage, and so be patient with me. But there's a lot of really great technical information found in this passage that helps us to really appreciate how accurate these statements are. Number one, he says he utters, and this can also be translated as he makes or he gives. And the thing that which he makes or gives is, as it says there, the voice. Well, the voice is an interesting word. And it is also translated in a number of ways, such as a sound, such as a trumpet, found in Joshua 6 and 5. A noise, such as a great assembly of people crying out at once, 1 Samuel 4:14. And also thunder, as is related to the sound associated with lightning, Exodus 19 and 16, which often accompanies hail and rain during severe thunderstorms, Exodus 9, verse 34. Then, with that idea, then comes this other word, this idea of multitude. The multitude of waters, what is it referring to? Well, it's obviously referring to a massive amount, and is in fact translated in 2 Chronicles chapter 31 and 10 as a great store. Great store, meaning that it's not just a great amount, but it's a great amount in storage. Waters, same as used in the Amos passage, is a generic, and we'll see that repeatedly. Now, the word heavens is important to note, and there's a couple of things with regard to its translation, but it is the same word as translated the sky in Amos chapter 9 and verse 6. There'll be more to come on that here in just a few minutes. So if we were to look at that first phrase and we were to transliterate it based on just the information I shared, we could literally rewrite this first phrase to be such. And think about it. You'll see this in some translations too. When he makes the sound of thunder, there is a vast amount of water stored in the sky above. Now, think about that. When we hear thunder, what do we already know is coming? And guaranteed to happen somewhere. Maybe not on us, but somewhere. And even if it doesn't fall, sometimes there's been cases, I'm sure, where we hear thunder and we never see the rain. Of course, that's called a teaser here in Oklahoma, and we get it all the time. But the idea that there is water storage connected to that is really important, because it means all of that which is above us is stored and ready to drop. The question becomes is, will it? Now, the word that we go on here into this quote from Psalms, says, "And he causes the vapors." Now, vapors is an important word to note here because it has a lot of impact on how we take that. Is it a literal vapor, such as we would talk about in a science classroom? Well, it turns out the word is not that accurate. First of all, the word is typically translated prince, governor, chief, or captain. Only in these passages, noted here at the top, Jeremiah and Psalms, only in these passages is this word translated vapor, which is in some translations rendered as clouds at times, which if either is correct, can't be determined. However, it is something of distinguishment based on the context of the other uses. It is stately or majesty in nature. And one thing I'll give you to think about is his royal majesty, the Son of God, will return riding upon a chariot of clouds, Romans chapter 1, verse 7, and may give us some significance as to what that majesty is, possibly more emphasis being on the cloud versus that of a vaporous, aqueous material. So it then goes on and it says, those vapors are to ascend. That is to rise up or to be lifted up. It denotes this aqueous mist moves against the force of gravity. It moves against the force of gravity. Even in the early days of understanding gravity, this works counterintuitively to the things in which we know about how water flows, because it has mass. Even vapor has mass and should sink. But there are other things here at play that we'll talk about in a few minutes that will help us to understand how this mass of material moves vertically, unlike that of springs or rivers. Then it talks about lightning. And lightning, of course, is very interesting. That word can be denoted a number of different ways in the Scriptures. It also has a word that's associated with arrows that fly through the air. But in this particular case, this word is a word that is used in significance to that of something bright or glittering, and in its context in other places, it relates typically to light reflecting off a finely polished steel blade of a sword. Then it says, he makes lightning for the rain. I really want us to understand this whole phrase. He makes lightning for the rain. And rain is a generic, and it's rain everywhere that we find it. But the point here is does he make lightning for the rain? Is that an accurate statement? When rain comes, does lightning be created just for the ability of rain to fall or something to that nature? Well, that already comes across as slightly problematic, but when you look into the Hebrew, that gets cleared up. In other translations, it is simply stated as he makes lightning with the rain, or may be better rendered from the root of the word to accompany the rain. And so that certainly makes more sense and is less problematic than this particular version, which is New King James. And then finally, the word treasuries. The word treasuries here is associated with the word wind, and it simply is translated storehouses. Storehouses, such as what we would find with regard to grain and other things in the Scriptures. Just as God is able to bring forth an abundance of atmospherically stored precipitation, he also has an abundance of wind, which he is able to call forth as well out of its storehouse. The next passage, I forgot I had some pretty pictures to go along with this, so that way it helped you to digest all of that information at once, but instead I gave it to you the hard way. But anyway, here's the point here. You can see the wall of water falling down below this cloud. You can certainly see a tremendous lightning storm associated with this thunderstorm as well. So now we move to this passage here, Job 36, 27, and 28. And I want you to think about this passage, because this is a problematic passage to apologeticists. And apologeticists have struggled with this passage for reasons I'll share with you here in just a second. For he draws up drops of water, which distill as rain from the mist, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Now, to make things a little easier, I'm going to approach it by looking at this last phrase, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Then I'll come back to the first phrase. The word clouds, also used as sky and heavens, but different than the words we noted previously in Amos and Jeremiah. There is in the Hebrew a lot of multiple words for various things, and sometimes it just deals with a specific aspect of that particular thing. But in this case here, it is that which is above. It says it drops down, and I would say that the better interpretation of that term based on the information I studied is pour, stream, or flow out, as it is used in other places. And it's really, and simplistically, you could say it is typically denoting that of a liquid being released. That's the simplest way I can put that. It is a liquid being released from something, typically a vessel, even from the clouds. Whatever the case is, it is a liquid released. And it's important to note that. And the next word, the word to pour, I think should be dropped down. I think literally the two words need to be flipped, because the word for drop down is something lowered or falling. And that is helpful in understanding this phrase, this particular statement, because in the order of which it comes, which the clouds drop down, or should be better, the pouring, and pour, and that should be the dropping down, abundantly on man, based on the usages in the Hebrew. Why do I say that? Because before something can drop, let's say I drop my phone, I'm not going to do it. The first thing I have to do before it can fall is I have to release it. I have to let go of it. And so really, this translation in the New King James Version is actually problematic because it puts it in the other order. But the Hebrew, thankfully, is consistent enough to understand that process. You must first release, then it can fall. Now, we'll deal with the more problematic part of this particular passage. And the more problematic part of this passage starts in the very beginning and really is all in that first line right there and a little bit of the second. It says, "For he draws up." Again, the idea of ascension, lifting up, has already occurred, and this is also consistent here. The King James Version says, though, that this idea is a little bit different than just that of lifting or ascending. It means to keep something small or to make it small. Consistent with the word diminish as translated elsewhere in the Scriptures, but it also is translated withdraws or takes away, which more aptly applies here and is commonly found in most modern translations. But then we get to the word drops. Now the word drops, this word is derived from a root word which is translated drip or drop, so it's accurate. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, in its context, it's typically in association with the morning dew, droplets, right? We can identify with that just like raindrops. We know what they look like and we can identify with them. But the problem here is that which is drawn up is a drop of water. Now my question to you right away is how do you get a drop of water from the surface up to the sky? Even a strong wind will blow it laterally, maybe a little bit of lift, but it's not going to lift more than tens of feet off the ground because of its volume and its mass. That is not going to be possible. Let's look at the next word that comes up, and that is which distill as rain. Typically, this denotes something purified or refined, such as silver or gold. Water in its purest form can be attained through ancient ways, the distillation process. You can simply create a distillant. Here's one done in the lab where you can take a Bunsen burner. You can heat a liquid. Once that material starts to boil or reach a significant temperature, water molecules will be released by vapor, meaning they're truly water vapor. They're in a water state. It's still liquid, even though it's being lifted by gases. And then when it runs through a cooled tube, it'll condensate and ultimately drip back into another flask. That's the distillation process. And the only way that can work is in cases like this around hot springs where you actually get the water temperature up high enough to get vapor, literal vapor, off the water body. So then the word mist, I do want to at least make sure we comment on the word mist here, from the mist. Mist is only used one other time in all of the Bible, and it's Genesis 2 and 6. A mist went up from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground. That's a pre-flood scenario, so it doesn't help us a lot, but it does, in fact, create some other complications. But in any case, the context of this passage says it has to be rain or possibly clouds. That's the association we're limited to because of the subject. But here's the situation that we have to ask ourselves. Is the distillation process accurate and are drops accurate? The answer from a technical standpoint is no. That is technically inaccurate. And apologeticists get themselves in trouble all the time when they use this passage and somebody smarter in the room hits them with it. So how do you get around it? Well, you just need to think about who's talking here. Who is talking here? It's a young man by the name of Elihu. And Elihu, according to Job 32 and 6, a young guy, shared his opinion, as he stated, in chapter 32, verse 10 and 17. He admitted there were things he did not know, verse 22 of 32. Spoke words from his heart, 33, verse 3. Claimed to have perfect knowledge. Woo, boy, I wish I had that. 36 and 4. And presumed to speak on God's behalf, 36 and 2. But here's what got him. He stated he had no sin. Job 33 and verse 9. And according to what we know in 1 John chapter 1 and verse 8, anyone who says they have no sin is a liar. This young man didn't know near as much as he thought he knew. And so he's not inspired. And when we understand the context of that passage, we don't have a problem anymore But the problem is, a lot of people who only want to look at the Bible for the scientific apologetics that are there, and as exciting as it is, haven't really understood some of the basic principles of Bible study. That's context, context, context. And so here he states the rains and the clouds formed by distillation. That's wrong. It is evaporation. And we'll note what that is in the very next verse here. Psalms 19, verse 4 and 6. In the heavens he has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Its rising is from one end of heaven, and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. All right, so we're going to start. We're going to get to that heat here in just a minute. But the heavens is identified in verse 1. That's why I've injected it here. And in this particular context, the heavens is associated with the sun in verse 4, and it refers to the void of space beyond Earth's atmosphere, where the celestial bodies, such as the moon and the stars, also reside. Earlier we noted this word can refer to Earth's atmosphere or the sky, but it can also refer to the region of outer space, or the combination of the two, since they can both be viewed simultaneously. As well as, also, in addition to that, it's also the place where God exists. The proper application of each, it has to be determined by the context of the passage. The sun, is identified there, is the heavenly body intended by God's design to provide light during the day, Genesis 1 and 6, or 16, which rises in the east and sets in the western sky as perceived from the human standpoint on earth, as is noted there in verse 6. Its circuit is simply that of the sun's path or its arc through the sky, not an orbital state, as some people try to infer. But here's the kicker, the heat. Only once is it translated heat in all the Bible, and that's here in verse 6. And that's problematic because sometimes that draws things out of context. At other times, though, it is simply translated sun, but it is not the same word as the word sun noted earlier in verse 4. It is instead derived from a word meaning something that is hot or warm, thus a word reserved for the sun, but specifically related to the heat or the warmth that the sun provides. Now, here's the exciting part, and if you're scientific and geeky like me, this is where you get all fired up. And I know it's like, yeah, you're geeky. All right. Early philosophers did not begin hypothesizing about the sun or our stars being such as Anaxagoras noted. I get ahead of myself. They didn't begin hypothesizing that the heat we feel on Earth is a direct result of the sun until after the Old Testament was completed and written. They did not even come up with that hypothesis until after the Old Testament is written. So that means all the other times that word for a heat element associated with the sun did not come until after the conclusion of the Old Covenant. That's important to note. It was Anaxagoras, who lived in Athens, Greece, around 450 BC, that thought the sun and the stars were fiery stones that emitted heat. All but the sun were too far away to feel the heat from them. However, his idea was met with disapproval, and he was finally imprisoned for impiety, for introducing sinful ideas and heresy. His idea was also occasionally entertained by others through the ages, but resulted in very similar results, such as individuals by Aristarchus and Galileo. So, not a good time to be an astronomer. But they were onto the right idea. But the idea didn't even culminate until well after the Old Testament. It wasn't until the 19th century that science proved heat is energy, radiation, sourced from the sun, and that it was the ultimate driver of the hydrologic cycle, causing water molecules to volatilize and to evaporate, just like this. And that this evaporative system is ultimately at a molecular level. What you have is you have water molecules all, and I could go crazy with terms right now, but I'm going to keep it simple. They're all little friends. They want to be close to each other. And when you pour it out of a glass and when you spill it, you notice it likes to stick together, right? We call that hydrophilic, meaning water-loving in its Greek term. It wants to be together. But here's the deal. Whenever the radiation hits them, it excites the molecules, and they get this rapid vibration going. And guess what? They start bumping their friends, and the friends don't like it. So guess what? He gets booted out. And what ultimately happens is these little H2O molecules start escaping off the surface because of radiative energy exciting the molecules. And it only happens in the very top part of the layer of water. This happens on the surface. It happens in water bodies. It happens even with plants. So the bottom line is, that wasn't understood. And if you go back for a second, that's wrong. Elihu had it wrong. But the psalmist had it right. And that's important to note. A couple more passages here. Time's getting away. Here Job is speaking. Job 26, verse 8. He binds up the water in his thick clouds, yet the clouds are not broken under it. The idea of binding is to bound, suppress, or hold back, often used in relationship or relation to an enemy being thwarted or taken captive. Not broken means not rent, according to the King James Version. Not torn, not divided, not breached, or not burst forth. These clouds have water in them, but it's not raining. They're holding it back. These clouds look ominously scary to where you think you're going to have a serious rainstorm, yet it holds back the floodwaters of the rain. Ecclesiastes 11 and 3, if the clouds are full of rain, finally hit some tipping point, they empty themselves upon the earth. The idea of rain clouds being full of rain, well, we see it all the time. They finally just start to rain. That's why there's a predictive ability that weather people and meteorologists can use. But you know, it has to reach that tipping point. I'm going to have to move along quickly. Not going to be able to spend as much time on some of these, but Psalm 65 and 9, you visit the earth and you water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. The idea of this word visit doesn't mean that God comes and delivers the water on his own, but instead he oversees, governs, or appoints, as that word is used. To water it is of limited use in the Old Testament, but infers the idea of giving a liberal portion to excess, overflowing, or running over, providing an abundant of rain. And the word full, same as used in Ecclesiastes 11 and 3 regarding the full clouds, also talks about here that you can also reach capacity of the rivers through rainfall. And that is accurate, whereas earlier we noted Aristotle made a counterstatement to that. The rainwater is then absorbed in the ground, it accumulates upon saturation, and eventually runs off the surface in sufficient amounts, if sufficient amounts are received. Well, time's getting away. So I've got a part here. I'm going to leave this. This is a teaser. We'll come back to it. Ask questions about springs and caverns and things like that, and we'll come back to that in the question and answer session. But the key is, and I want to jump ahead here to the main thrust of this, Ecclesiastes 1 and 7. We started here earlier. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. We've now seen through the scriptures that the process is accurate in the Bible, and to quite some detail, and that's the amazing part of it. It's not just very lightly brushed over, but it is very specific as to what exactly is taking place. Even in the groundwater system, I'll show you in the question and answer, it also is extremely accurate. The key is that the Bible says the ocean, this vast amount of blue, it is the ultimate reservoir and source of water on earth. And that the transportation of that water from the ocean to the lands is in these big cloud systems you see here. And there is certainly enough material there to ultimately transport those things. I'll skip this one for now. There you go. You didn't get a chance to read it. So you have to come back to it if you want it. But here's the whole point of all of this. Why do we even study this here today? Well, obviously inspiration is an important point. But you know, God had a greater purpose for the hydrologic cycle. We noticed this verse earlier, but this last part I want you to notice. Not only does he give water to the earth and fill the rivers, you provide their grain, for so you have prepared it. Isaiah 30 and 23 says, then he will give the rain for your seed with which you sow the ground, and bread of the increase of the earth. It will be fat and plentiful in the day your cattle will feed in large pastures. What's the purpose of the whole hydrologic cycle to begin with? It's to give earth sustenance, to to ultimately provide life. Plants need the water to grow. Animals need the plants to eat. We need the plants and the animals because we like a larger buffet. And we need the water also. It sustains life. And in fact, in this particular passage, Isaiah says in Isaiah 55, 10 and 11, "For as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven, and do not return there, but water the earth and make it bring forth its bud and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater. So shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing which I sent it." The hydrologic cycle stands as a testimony that when God has a purpose for something, He will see it through. And His word is represented by this hydrologic cycle in this particular passage. He has a purpose for His word for man. And at the end of the day, it's not going to return to Him void. It's going to do what its purpose is for those who will choose to follow and obey it. And the same will work for the hydrologic cycle. I'm going to cut it there because time's out. Thank you.